Great, everyone here. So until the tea break, I had no idea what I was going to talk about. So I did make a few notes and dredge out something I made some notes on a while back, but we'll see how we go. So I'm going to talk about three things. And there's not much in life that's original in a sense, in the way of talking about things. But I am going to talk about three things that I didn't come up with these three things. I came across these on a TED.com talk 5-6 years ago. Good website, by the way, if you want to go and see some really inspirational talks on a whole range of topics, science, religion, lots of good stuff. And this was a talk by a chap called Neil Pasricha. And he came up with this after his life went off the rails. His best friend committed suicide, his wife left him, he lost his job. And he went on a huge downward spiral. In his own words, really totally lost the plot on life. He really didn't know where he was going. Directionless, signless. And in the end it was, you know, a couple of friends that pulled him through from all this stuff happening. And the transformation that he went through, you know, he came up with these three things that he called the three A's. So attitude, awareness and authenticity. So what I'm going to do is kind of take those three A's and put them kind of in a Buddhist context, possibly, maybe. We'll see how it transforms. And some of the things that Neil mentioned in that talk, it's kind of going back to basics. Some of the things that he came up with around enjoying just what's there. So enjoying when you're in a queue in the supermarket and the aisle next to you suddenly opens up with a cashier and you're first in the queue, score. That kind of feeling when you put fresh sheets on your bed and on that first night and you're getting the clean sheets. It's kind of nice, isn't it? There's just something about clean sheets that feels nice. So some of these simple things, and you know, in the talk, Neil said that, you know, it was reminded himself of some of this innate beauty, some of this simplicity in life that brought him back into the land of the living, that made him appreciate what he had. Made him appreciate that he'd gone through a lot of loss, but he also had a lot to be grateful for. So that's how, you know, he's the person that came out with the three A's, and obviously I'll talk about them in a Buddhist context, but he kind of sparked that seed in me. And one of those kind of attitudes is very closely linked to when I opened the class this morning and talking about our intention, right intention, that Samasankappa, the second limb of the Noble Eightfold Path. So this first A, attitude, intention, resolve, all very closely linked. In a sense, for me, attitude, it defines who we are as individuals. And it's kind of a make or break scenario, isn't it? Our attitude is what takes us through every moment of our day, every moment of our week, our month, our life. You know, the attitude that we approach life with directly impacts our experience. You know, if we approach life from a negative perspective, what's our experience going to be? More negative than positive. And Sangharakshita says in one of his books, you learn what it is you're trying to do in the process of doing it, or in the process of trying to do it. You learn what it is you're trying to do in the process of trying to do it. And that's very true. And it's being able to approach everything we do with the right attitude, with the right intention. And that second bit of Noble Eightfold Path. That makes or breaks. You know, if we just approach everything negatively, then we're going to struggle. We're really going to struggle. If we have a more positive attitude, we'll struggle less. We're still going to struggle. There's still going to be challenges. But bringing a sense of positivity to everything we do, be it meditation, to our daily commute, to walking to the shops, to turning the news off like I did this morning because I didn't want to hear about tomorrow's tornado or whatever the the weathermen are threatening. You know, the attitude can be so transformational. And the Buddha talked about our attitude again and again and again in different ways. But oftentimes, in my view, I find myself resisting my experience. So I'm experiencing something, and I find myself resisting it, trying to push it away. You know, I become impatient with what's going on because it's not what I want to happen. I want things to be other than they actually are. And if I have that attitude of resistance, no, I don't want it to rain today, or no, this bus journey I had last night took me forever. If I have that attitude, you know, it does change my mood. It changes how I approach people, how I approach events, my relationship with myself. And ultimately, our relationships with ourselves define our relationship with others. How we are with ourselves flows over into how we are with others. So if we're constantly negative, with a poor attitude, or less skillful attitude, that will affect how we are with other people. But the more we come back to the present, you know, just how my experience actually is, I'm on the bus, I'm fed up, but that's all right. That's all right. And the more we come back to the present and maintain an active interest in what's going on, what we're doing and why we're doing it, that will change our attitude. It will change our attitude. To step into the present. You know, and being in the present, you know, contains, and there's a Buddhist sutra on, the Mahayana sutra on this, but being in the present contains both past and future. You know, so we have a sense of gratitude for the past, we have a sense of responsibility for the future. So when we're in the present, there's now, there's this sense of gratitude for what's happened to get us to this point, and there's a sense of underlying responsibility for the future, and we don't know what the future holds. We have a responsibility to that, to the future, responsibility to ourselves and to others. And if we have a positive attitude, then that responsibility is going to play out better. We're going to be able to contribute in a more positive way to what happens in the future. And that's quite hard, because modern neuroscience tells us that the brain has a negative bias. I'm not a scientist, some of you here are. But neuroscience tells us that brain has a negative bias. So perhaps we're inclined towards dukkha. It's a Buddhist term, literally translated as suffering. As I mentioned a few weeks ago, if you break dukkha down into its two compound words, it actually means unhappy, unpleasant space. The kah bit in dukkha is space, and the prefix du is... it's negative, it's antithetical, so unhappy, unpleasant space. So perhaps because of what neuroscience is saying, we have this inclination towards negativity, this inclination towards dukkha. But you can understand that, because in evolution, you know, as we've evolved over hundreds of thousands of years, we needed to know the bad in order to survive. You know, when people were living in caves, they needed to know to get out of the bad weather to survive, to hide out from wild animals. So an attitude of positivity, of doing something positive, is demonstrably better than one of negativity. And you can change from being a negative person, to a positive person. There's a couple of really good books on that. A chap called David Taylor, who's written about being a neg, and how it's got, and how you can become a positive person. I think I'm a little way along that journey, because I've always been a neg most of my life, and I'm gradually sort of notching towards, I'm still on that sort of bit more neg scale, but maybe one day I'll get to the halfway point, I don't know. But you can change, like your personality type can change. If you've done things like Myers-Briggs over the years with training and practice, you can see that change. I don't think I'll ever change from being an introvert to an extrovert, but some people do. And there's a quote from Atisha, who was a 10th century, I think it was, Indian master of meditation, he's known as. And he said, all activities should be done with one intention. All activities should be done with one intention. And that intention is a willingness to be kind to ourselves and thus influence the world around us in a positive way. So with kindness to ourselves, we have a positive influence on the world around us. And that comes on to things that we practice here, like the Metta Bhavana meditation. We're looking at cultivation of loving kindness. You know, metta is not an emotion. Metta, loving kindness, is not a feeling either. Metta is more an attitude. Metta is something we do. You know, we do metta. We don't just wait to, oh, I feel quite kind of open and connected with people today. You know, metta, we have to do it. We have to practice it. We have to engage with it. We have to live it. Otherwise, it ain't going to happen. And what underlies metta, loving kindness, is a word I mentioned earlier on, is gratitude. It's kind of, if you're having trouble getting that metta really kind of rocking, come back to basic gratitude. Be grateful for what you've got. Be grateful for your health. Be grateful for home. Be grateful for food, for family, for friends. You know, that attitude of gratitude is the phrase that's the baseline for metta. So an attitude of metta is a really good place to aim for. And it may not be a place that we can inhabit or dwell in every moment of every day, but if we can at least have experiences of true metta, experiences of when we're truly open on friendly terms with ourselves and others, regardless of the situation, it makes a difference. It's a positive way of living in the world. And there's a lovely piece in the, I can't remember the sutta, it's embarrassing, Nibbādhika Sutta, that's the one, from the Anguttara Nikaya. And in that, the Buddha says something really simple, and he's talking about intention. He says, intention, I tell you, is kamma. That's the Pali word for karma. Intention, I tell you, is karma. Intending, one does karma by way of body, by way of speech, by way of mind. And that part of karma, that part of karma that we always forget, people overlook it again and again and again. Karma literally means action. Before you do any action, you have an intention to do. Before you do anything, you have to intend to do it. Before you stand up, you have to intend to stand up. Before you prepare a meal, you have to intend to prepare the meal. So intention is a fundamental part of karma, and it's really easy to overlook that. So if we bring a negative intention, a negative attitude towards things, what's the action going to be like? More positive or more negative? Kind of common sense in a way. So just going back to that simple truth, you know, before any action you have an intention. Cetana. There's always going to be an intention before you do something. And that bias, that attitude that you bring to it, will define more or less what the outcome of the action is, or how you experience the action. That comes down to simple things as well, like when we sit to meditate and our posture. Now, whatever posture we adopt in meditation is an embodied intention. Now, if you sit to meditate and you know you're sleeping and you're leaning forward, chances are you might have a bit of a difficult meditation. You might fall flat on your face and get a nosebleed. It's happened to me. So posture is an embodied intention. So many things are an embodied intention. If you sit there in a meeting at work and you've got your legs crossed and you've got your arms crossed, that's negative. You will feel that crossing in your body's energy. You will feel your flow of energy is blocked if you sit there with everything crossed in a meeting. Some people may notice and pick up on it as well. And you will be projecting, consciously or otherwise, a less than wholesome, a less than skillful attitude, just because of the way that you're sitting. Just sort of notice next time you're in a meeting or on a function with other people. See, you're sitting there with body parts crossed, legs, arms, or whatever. Just see if that rings true for you. It's really fascinating. Don't make it too obvious, because people might think you're weird. Mm-hmm. Like you're sort of looking under the table at legs and stuff, you might get in trouble, but just sort of notice if that rings true for you. And, you know, the other part of posture when we sit to meditate is to remember that any posture is able to help us cultivate awareness. I just erased my notes, which was really helpful. So any posture can help us cultivate our awareness. It can really help us to concentrate or otherwise. You know, if we are, like I said, if we're slouching, if we're sitting kind of half interested, if we're kind of leaning on something else, and our minds will go somewhere else and we won't be given our full attention. We'll have that attitude of, can't really be bothered. So simple things like posture have a big impact on our attitude, on how we approach things. So this kind of posture, that kind of leads me in really to the second A, you know, that helping us to cultivate awareness through our posture. Well, the second A is awareness. You know, we talk about sati in Buddhism, mindfulness, awareness, they're kind of interchangeable. Now the word mindfulness has been really abused in recent years. It's great that mindfulness is being taught in schools and in businesses and stuff, and I really support that. But I think the word mindfulness itself is quite a poor translation of sati. If you look at what sati really is, you know, it comes from a root which literally means to recollect or to remember. And I think a much better translation is present moment awareness, because that's what sati is. You know, we have the Anapanasati Sutta, being aware of our breath, of what's coming in and coming out. The Satipatthana Sutta, again, all about the four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind, and mindfulness of phenomena. So sati is probably the most mentioned technical term in Buddhist suttas. And it is so key. You know, awareness is so key to everything that we do, every moment of our lives. If we can just bring a little bit more awareness, our experience will be different. It will be more positive, because we're more aware of what's going on. Really important, you know, talking about mindfulness or awareness, I'll use the two terms interchangeably, but really important to remember that from a Buddhist perspective, that sati does not stand alone. So it's not just about mindfulness or sati. Sati was never meant to be the whole path. It's meant to work in conjunction with other factors, with other aspects that the Buddha taught, ethics, for example. It's meant to be aligned with these other factors. The Noble Eightfold Path being probably the best example that I can think of. So, you know, sati is part of the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path, we look at our views, our intention, our speech, our action, our livelihood, what we do for a living, the effort we put into life. We look at mindfulness, we look at concentration. That's the Noble Eightfold Path. So awareness, mindfulness is a fundamental part of life, but it doesn't stand alone. It has to work, cooperate, be informed by these other aspects that the Buddha mentioned on the Eightfold Path. And I mentioned earlier on that, you know, sati comes from this root to recollect or to remember. And it really struck me the other day, thinking, how much of my life I live in a kind of state of forgetfulness of being. You know, kind of forgetting the good things that I have, the good things that I've experienced, the good things that I've done, the good things that hopefully I do from time to time. You know, and I forget just to be present for what is. You know, it goes back to what I said talking about attitude. I'm trying to change my experience to be something other than it is. If I can just be aware of my experience just as it is, and be okay with that, that's transformational. That does make such a difference to how you live your life. Just because you're more aware of what's happening for you. If you're more aware of what's going on for a colleague at work. You know, you can see they're struggling, you can see they're stressed, perhaps they've got some challenges at home. You can really change the work environment just through being a little bit more aware, and you reach out to someone. The same with family members and friends, just extending out your awareness is a big deal. It really is. And you know, coming back to talking about sati specifically from a Buddhist perspective, sati stands in relationship to a problem. Stands in relationship to a problem. And that problem is the D word again, it's dukkha. Suffering, unsatisfactoriness. But without awareness, without mindfulness, we don't often see that. We're not always able to clock, actually, I'm behaving this way because my attitude is really poor, the way that I'm looking at that. And actually, why am I dwelling on that when, if I had a more positive approach, I could transform my working day? Because with awareness, there is freedom. You know, we can free ourselves from this. It's almost in a way like we're attached to suffering. It's almost like we actually enjoy in a perverse kind of way our suffering. Suffering defines who we are, so I want to suffer today or else. You know, our attitude can change that. It really can. And our awareness helps us to clock it so we can make that change. So with awareness there is freedom. There absolutely is freedom. Freedom from what? Big question. Could be freedom from behaving in a conditioned way. So you could say freedom from conditioned existence. You know, freedom from doing what we've always done and getting what we've always got. You know, that was Freud's definition of madness, wasn't it? Somewhat. If you do what you've always done, you get what you've always got. So don't change anything. Guess what? You're just going to keep going through this spin cycle in the washing machine over and over and over again. So awareness is what sets us apart from others who may be less aware for whatever reason. It has this really positive effect of keeping us from becoming sort of submerged in a kind of less positive mindset. And you know, one thing that Sangha Akshaya says of mindfulness is it's an essential quality of the individual. An essential quality of the individual, because without it we're just going to be like everyone else. You know, if we're not aware of how we are, what we're doing and why we're doing it, oftentimes we just go along with what everyone else is doing, behave how they are, and our behaviour could be less skillful than it could be, to put it politely. So awareness has this transformative ability to, it's not that you want to stand out from the crowd or be distant or remote or be seen as a bit weird and wacky, that might happen. Just that you'll be able to see the bigger picture. You'll be able to respond rather than react. And awareness, you know, as we teach, especially in the mindfulness of breathing, when you're becoming aware or mindful of the breath, that first stage of mindfulness of breathing is all about relaxation. And it's really key to learn to relax. When we learn to relax, you become more able to observe. More able to observe your experience and the experience of others. You can observe what's already here, regardless of what it is. You just observe it. And that simple act, in Buddhist terms again, diminishes the power of a sense of self, of I, of me, of mine. Because it makes space for our awareness to come forward. It makes space for the awareness to step up to the forefront of our life. And in that space, like I said just now, we respond rather than react. We can be more creative. We're better able to meet life just as it is without trying to change it. Because if we try to change or control everything, all that's going to do is obscure our awareness. just going to obscure it, because we're too busy trying to change something. So our awareness kind of gets a bit blindfolded, a bit sidelined, and it's not able to show us what's really going on. So trying to control everything obscures our awareness rather than releases our awareness. That's a big deal, because awareness is a radically different perspective. A radically different perspective on how we live, society at large. And you know, we often see society encouraging us to take control of all aspects of our lives, family, friendships, health. If you buy that car, you'll be happy. If you buy that bit of tech, you'll be really happy. And if you eat this bit of food, you'll be monstrously happy, even though it's got 2,000 calories and whatever. You know, so we are kind of programmed, we're kind of afflicted from all sides in society, and awareness just helps us to clock that. Doesn't mean we'll always do the right thing, definitely not. It does mean that we're just a little bit more aware of what's going on around us. Hopefully, sometimes, maybe, possibly. And that makes a difference. You've got to start somewhere. And one that there's a, I don't remember who taught me this phrase a few years ago. But it was about stop rehashing the past and rehearsing the future. Just be with what is. Be with your experience just as it's there. And how often do we find ourselves ruminating about stuff that's already happened? Or rehearsing about something that hasn't happened yet? Rather than just saying, this is just what's going on for me right now. Yeah, planning has its place in life, but quite often we spend so much of our lives planning, we ignore what's happening right in front of our eyes. So it's getting that balance right, and that Buddhist seesaw is a difficult one to kind of balance. And you just got to experiment with it. So stop rehashing the past and rehearsing the future. Just step into the present and just be there with it, notice it. Enjoy the flavours of it, the textures of it, the colours of it, the sounds of it. And see if that makes a difference. And there's an extract, and I'm going to read you about four lines from a brilliant sutta. Sutta Nipata is some of the earliest teachings of the Buddha. And there's a section right at the end of this sutta where there's a whole bunch of Brahmins and other spiritual attainees just firing off loads of questions at the Buddha. And then in the first section of this, Ajita, who we're told was quite a senior Brahmin, was, he said to the Buddha, "What is it," said Ajita, "that smothers the world? What makes the world so hard to see? What would you say pollutes the world, and what threatens it most?" And the Buddha replied, "It is ignorance which smothers," said the master, "and it is carelessness and greed which make the world invisible. The hunger of desire pollutes the world, and the great source of fear is the pain of suffering. In every direction," said Ajita, "the rivers of desire are running. How can we dam those rivers? What will hold them back? What can we use to close the floodgates? Any river can be stopped with the dam of mindfulness," said the Buddha. "I call it the flood stopper. And with wisdom you can close the floodgates." Easy, isn't it? So, you know, the Buddha gives a very clear lesson there that with mindfulness, you're aware what's going on in every aspect of your life. And you can make that dam. You can stop the flood from impinging you and carrying you away. That's how strong mindfulness, awareness actually is. So it's kind of understanding that rather than trying to control this awareness, though, if we relax into it, we become more who we really are. We become the real us. We become more authentic, which is the third A. That's a good link, isn't it? So it becomes the third A. So we talked about attitude, talked about awareness. I'm going to move on to authenticity, which is probably the kind of A that I kind of struggle with the most, in a sense. authenticity. You know, it's a word that appears quite a lot, not in that sense in Buddhist texts. A word we hear a lot in life. Be authentic, be the real you. What does that actually mean? You know, in Buddhist terms, with authenticity, it's about abiding naturally, genuinely, openly, abiding honestly, noticing the arising of this moment just as it is, authentically, being in harmony with what is happening, allowing life in, being who we are, where we are, no matter what the situation is. One of the things when I first talked about this a couple of years ago, and just looking at this now, I think, it's a kind of sense. No, it's allowing the wisdom of our practice to permeate all of our life. You know, so the things that we study, the things that we teach, the things that we reflect upon, the things that the Buddha taught. You know, the Dharma is not some sort of static thing that we just bring in once in a while and think, well, yeah, that makes a bit of sense, that might work. You know, it's allowing the Dharma to permeate our entire life. Our entire life. Because by doing that, it reveals the authentic me. It reveals who I really am in that moment. I'm not static, you're not static. Who you are will change. Now, that's one of the good things about impermanence, isn't it? You know, people sometimes think there's the truth of impermanence in Buddhism is very negative. Oh, nothing lasts forever, we're all going to die. Well, that's true, isn't it? But we're also not stuck in a static sense of always being the same person, always having to respond how we've always responded. Because we can change. We can change our attitude. We can bring awareness through every situation. So we change. So we can become more authentic. And by doing that, you know, we start to break down these boundaries. You know, quite often we have this kind of, speaking for me, this kind of mental boundary around myself, thinking, right, those are my boundaries and that's as far as I'm able to go because I'm this limited kind of being who, you know, can do some stuff but not others. And by allowing awareness to inform our life more and more and more, seeing the truth of things like impermanence, we break down these boundaries. And these restrictions become less restricted. We can chip away at them until they fall away. So it's a very practical and immediate experience because we can always just chip away, you know, chip by chip by chip until it's gone. So it's very practical. And by doing that, we allow our individuality to shine through, to inform our being, to inform our very lives. You know, we see with insight who we truly are. Not who we think we are, or who we think others think we are. And we just allow it to be. We learn to sit with that, warts and all. I'm not a perfect being, but a bit better than I was 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 8 years ago. You know, sometimes it's helpful to look back at the past and just say, yeah, I can see some positive transformation. But we do that with awareness, so we can use that to inform how we are in the present. And in Buddhism, the primary way that we discover our authenticity, and you probably guessed it, is through meditation. Because that's what brings us up to the coalface of our experience. Every time we sit to meditate, you come up against what's going on for you right now, who you are in this moment. Not that moment yesterday or the moment tomorrow, right now. Because your mind is constantly turning, your body is constantly responding in a different way. Mind and body are interacting in this interdependent way. You might sit really peacefully and calmly one day, next day you'll have an aching back or a sore leg or whatever else. You know, but in meditation we come face to face with what's going on right in this moment. And this succession of moments, you know, we sat for what, 35 minutes this morning. My mind was all over the place to start with. You know, it was jumping here and there, and, you know, and just trying to relax and slow that down and bring awareness to that quietens the mind down. You know, meditation is not about stopping thoughts, just about being aware of the thoughts happening and not paying attention to and not giving in to the thought. There's always going to be thoughts. If there wasn't, you could be struggling a bit. How would you do anything? So when we're more authentically ourselves, we live more of our life how we actually are. People see the real us. You know, it's not just about being kind or compassionate when you're here at the Buddhist Centre. I'm not saying it's not a good thing to be kind and compassionate when you're here at the Buddhist Centre, but you know, it's a better thing to bring that into your whole life. You know, our practice begins to pervade all aspects of our life. It's kind of the idea. The things that we learn, the things that we study, the things that we reflect upon, start to pervade our life. Just that, just our life. And you may not be fully conscious of that at times, and it could just be a gradual effect. Gradually you notice, oh, I responded differently there. I didn't respond in that reactive way that I used to. And that may not have been a conscious response. It may have just happened. That's the magic of meditation. It does do that. It really does. People will notice. They might not say something, or some people might do. But people will notice that you are changing, that you are in this state of flux. You know, you may have a calmer approach in a crisis, or a more skillful response in a difficult situation. You may have a compassionate look at something difficult rather than turning away. How often do you see a homeless person begging for money and you turn away? You can have a compassionate look and just say, you must be in a really bad way, may you be well. There's nothing stopping you from silently saying, may you be well. Just in that moment, directly, unmediated, not planned, just an authentic human response. By doing metta-bhavana, by doing mindfulness of breathing, we touch into this depth of authenticity, this well of who we actually are, and it starts to come to the surface. Just for doing a simple thing like shutting our eyes and sitting on a cushion or a chair, it's great, isn't it? If you could box it and sell it, you know, we'd earn a lot of money for the centre. Unfortunately, it's not that easy, as you all know. So we begin to understand that it's not about integrating the Dharma into our life, but it's more about integrating our life into the Dharma. That's something that Dharmadipa at Padmaloka said to me years ago, and it's always stuck. And that reminds me of something that Dogen, who was a 13th century Zen master, Dogen said, "Those who see worldly life as an obstacle to Dharma see no Dharma in everyday actions. They have not yet discovered that there are no everyday actions outside of Dharma." So I'll just say that again. "Those who see worldly life as an obstacle to Dharma see no Dharma in everyday actions. They have not yet discovered that there are no everyday actions outside of Dharma." So the Dharma is all-encompassing. If we allow our life to move in to the Dharmic world, to be informed by the teachings of the Buddha, but by the teachings that we're currently able to relate to respond to work with. I'm not going to get them all in one bang. If you did, you'd be enlightened. But if you're able to just work with where you are, how you are, with what you've got, it is transformative. You start seeing that it informs all your life, not just the bits of your life. So you have a direct knowledge that's grounded in your experience, not anybody else's experience, just yours. That's a direct knowing, a direct knowledge, because you're able to clock what's going on for you right now, authentically, in a real way. And one of the things, talking about authenticity, there's a famous sutta in Anguttara Nikaya, the Kalama Sutta, which many of you would have heard of. And the Buddha says Kalamas, so the Kalamas were a tribe, a group of people around that time, and the Buddha said, Kalamas, when you yourselves know these things are good, these things are not blameable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness. Enter on and abide in them. So the Buddha was saying there, when you authentically, genuinely, intuitively know that these things are good, these things are encouraged or praised by the wise, as the Buddha said, if you undertake and observe these things, they lead to benefit and happiness. So the Buddha was saying just that, you know, by checking into your authentic self, you will have a more direct knowing, a more direct experience of what is going on, and you'll be better able to say, that's skillful or that's unskillful. That's a right teaching, that's a wrong teaching, that's a right view, that's a wrong view. So Dharma practice is revolutionary. You know, it will at times be uncomfortable, and it's certainly challenging. But to really feel the effect of the Dharma, you have to live intimately with it. You have to live, breathe, walk it. You have to hold it up to scrutiny. That's what the Buddha was saying in the Kalama Sutta. You know, hold up these teachings to scrutiny. But also let the Dharma hold you to scrutiny too. Now look at some of the things that the Buddha taught. Put them into the context of your life again and again and again. The Dharma won't let you down. It will not let you down. And move towards a life of simplicity, humility, sincerity, kindness, compassion. As you progress, these qualities will naturally mature. And more of your life will perhaps be led to the service of the Dharma, towards saying, well, actually, you know, what I've learned from the Buddha and from my teachers, it does work, demonstrably so. And I want to give a little thing back to that. Even though at times you don't realise it, it's working away in the background, constantly. You know, we're born with these underlying tendencies, the anusiyas. And those tendencies can shape how we respond and react. But our attitude and our awareness and our authenticity can start changing some of that programming. You know, we can start to live more out of our authentic self, more in the present moment with our current experience just as it is. And the Buddha there said in the Vatupama Sutta, which is from the Majjhima Nikaya, he said, just as the white cloth instantly takes up the colour of the dye, so the purified mind takes up the truth of the Dharma. Just as the white cloth instantly takes up the colour of the dye, so the purified mind takes up the truth of the Dharma. So we work on ourselves, we work on our mental state, and we purify ourselves in the process. We change who we are. We take the three A's to heart. And we look at our attitude, awareness and authenticity, and allow them to transform us. Let them in. Let life happen. Whatever's happening is happening. You're not going to control it. But you can change. And you can change from moment to moment to moment. So that's the three A's. Thank you, Neil Pashwitcher, but with a bit of a Buddhist flavour on it. So we've got sort of 10 minutes for questions if people want to discuss anything that I've mentioned or bring up anything else. Any other items of Dharma that you may be thinking about, or I don't know tonight's lottery numbers, so don't ask that one.
It's not so much a question, but I'm sort of with you on this, sort of trying to move from neg to pos. But what I experience sometimes is what I call people's relentless positivity, which I guess really doesn't feel terribly authentic. You know, to be positive, you've got to hold the negative as well somehow. So it just feels that you can try a bit too hard to be positive.
It is that balance, that seesaw that I mentioned, because it's important. And like I mentioned, you know, neuroscience telling us that we're inclined, have this bias towards negative. Well, that's evolutionary, like I said, because it is. We have to know the bad in order to survive. So I think it is important to be able to hold negativity quite lightly. And there'll be times when we're a bit further away from a neg and we may just get pulled back into it. Because guess what? Life happens. And I've met people who are blazingly positive and they sometimes drive me mad. Just think, yes, but, you know, I bet that person goes away and gets into a darkened room sometime and screams. But it's a difficult one. It's a really good question, but it's something to definitely keep in mind, that, you know, life is not a bed of roses every day. There's going to be good and bad and something in between, and it's just coming into a more direct relationship and appreciation of that simple fact.
Friends is relentlessly positive, and I really struggle with it. But it does kind of, I these days I do try and learn more from the fact that she's at that end, and it plays out in her life, you know. Good things happen. So I try not to kind of pick too many holes in it.
Yeah, I've always thought whether introverts like me respond differently to people who are more positive. I don't know. I've not really thought it through. Whether are extroverts generally more positive, or do they just appear that way to introverts? Don't know. No idea. I've not really thought it through. But
I think they could be very insecure, actually. I think when you spoke saying that I might become extrovert, I don't think it's necessarily a better thing.
No,
to be
no.
Extrovert, is it?
I'll never be an extrovert.
Okay, either way.
But we can move on that scale. We do naturally move.
How do you handle people if their default setting is no to everything?
Yeah. Tough one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess it's just trying to help them see the broader context, the bigger picture. But it's, you know, some people are so used to, well, this glass is always half empty. And it's just trying to help them open their eyes. And sometimes, you know, that could take weeks or months just to open their eye a bit more. Just to say, actually, this thing that you just said, and I experience it at work quite a lot from people whose default is no. Because that's what they've always done, because that's how the previous regime used to do it. And trying to say, well, actually now our default is yes. And we only say no when these parameters come into play. That's not a quick change. And depending on the situation, if you're constantly with a person or people who are defaulting to no, you know, sometimes we just have to accept that. Sometimes all we can do is take ourselves out of that situation if it's unhealthy for us. But if we feel resourced and able, we can jump in there and, you know, we can be that positive person and say, hey, we can change this. No, you're no, we can say yes. You know, your reign's going to be my son. But we have to feel resourced in ourselves to be up for that challenge. Because otherwise, you're just going to, wall head are going to meet and you're going to get some pain in between. So I don't know the magic answer, but I think each situation on its merits, and you know, I'd like to think that we're all able in our own way just to help people gain a different perspective. You know, but before I came here to the Buddhist Centre 8 years ago, I thought, you know, I'd heard of meditation, I thought, what a bunch of wackos. You know, what's that achieving? They're just going to sit down and be quiet for half an hour and that's it. now 8 years later, and I start to experience the transformative potential and see, you know, I've cracked open my perspective so many different ways just through meditating, just through looking at things differently. I'd like to think that we can all take that into a experience with people whose default is no, and help them see, maybe not instantly but over time, how they can change. But if we could bottle the answer for that, if we knew what it was, then we'd do well.
Well, I've got a question I'd like to ask people in general, really. What do they think it is? Maybe it's only me that feels this. You might respond, you might resonate with this, but sometimes I can feel that willful negativity on my part is so much more emotionally filling than positivity. You know, I feel like I'm really here when I'm willfully being negative about something. Whereas if I'm I might be answering my own question here, but perhaps it isn't real positivity then. You know, perhaps it's superficial positivity. I mean, such as not doing that, perhaps that's why it's not actually satisfying. But I just wondered if anybody else had that sense that it's much, much more satisfying somehow to be heartbroken than it is to be,
anyway. Maybe it's connecting with actually how you're feeling. So you might be feeling incredibly kind of downtrodden, but you can see that. I guess if you can recognise that's how you're feeling, it's like, do I express that, or do I be super positive, or do I just be... difficult. Do I want to be difficult? But when I've done that, in fact, I did it this morning, Ruth, and then I just thought, I could see what I was doing. Mm. So I guess that's how it plays out for me. But I think there's something of getting it out. It kind of needs to get out somehow in a relatively harmless way. Yeah. But
so
I don't
that
know.
Sounds a little bit like the awareness and the attitude. Really.
I'm aware of what it does, of the power of it, but it's also because it's been latent, because it's been stewing up. Mm. I'm aware that that is there as well. So it's kind of
Sometimes it's nice just to feel the feeling strong. No, what feeling is in the way, isn't it? Yeah.
I think real positivity is very satisfying. Mm. It really does make you glow. Yeah. But it's not always like that. Sometimes you can be a bit on the surface. Yeah, let's just do this, it'll be wonderful. Without that depth of engagement behind it, maybe.
Do you also have to distinguish between like what's positive and what's pleasant? Because isn't it necessarily the same? And equally, what's negative and what's unpleasant? I mean, traditionally, confession is said to be very positive, but often very painful. And equally, well, I think anger can feel intensely sort of satisfying. I wouldn't really see it as necessarily being negative. I think it'd be negative to kind of act it out and play it out and take it out on other people and just sort of project it in all kinds of unskillful ways. But actually, just the feeling, it might be really energising and very dynamic. And I think it's easy superficially. I've really done this to sort of just stifle some of those negative kind of feelings. And it hasn't really been very effective.
Anger can definitely be positive. Mm-hmm. You know, there's instances in the Pali Canon when the Buddha is talking about using our anger to change our direction, using our anger skillfully rather than unskillfully to allow us to actually, okay, now I've got some energy. Because anger, there's generally some energy there. Mm-hmm. Now, anger might only be one letter away from danger, mm-hmm. but oftentimes with anger there is energy. And then we can use that energy, we can channel that energy to do something different. So sometimes...
Anger doesn't have to contain hatred, does it?
No.
Although it often does. Mm. It doesn't have to.
Because quite oftentimes it does, because underlying anger is this thing called fear. Mm. You know, someone cuts you up in the car. What's that about? There's fear under that, because you were afraid you or the car might get damaged.
Mm.
So there was a fear component to the anger.
Mm.
No, go ahead. The first thing for me, and I used to be quite an angry person. You might find that a bit weird, but I did. I used to be a real angry driver, Mr. Road Rage. And for me, the first thing was just bringing awareness to it. As it arose, clock it. As it arose, clock it. As it arose, clock it. Eventually, when you clock it, it gets really fed up of being noticed. And it does just start to go away. And then the more you start to clock it, you then start to see what's underlying it, what's under it. Was there fear underlying that? Was there a bit of anxiety or stress underlying that? And by bringing awareness to it, that's when the act of transformation starts. So you can then divert that energy somewhere else. Oh, actually, if I put all the energy I got into shouting out my windscreen, that lorry who can't possibly hear me, and put that energy into reflecting on the Dharma, or put that energy into an extra 15 minutes meditation, that's how you start to kind of divert it in a more positive way. But again, you know, we're all individual. We have to be able to just bring awareness to each moment as it arises for us, with our own background, our own tendencies, our own underlying tendencies, as I mentioned. Just understand those, understand our habitual responses, because we all have those habitual responses. And then we can start to transform them. Hope that helps a bit. So I think we're out of time. It's 1 o'clock. So thank you very much for coming. Something got warmer. Hopefully this tornado is not going to happen. And enjoy the rest of your weekend. Enjoy the sun. And may the Dharma be with you, as they say in the Star Wars. Not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.